Hi, this is Mark Shanahan. I'm the director of the play you just heard, as well as the curator for the Westport Country Playhouse Radio Theater. Over the past year, theater artists have turned to many new and old ways to practice the art of storytelling. And when artistic director Mark Lamos asked me to think on ways in which we could invite the Playhouse audience to come together through the medium of radio, I immediately turned to my good friend, the playwright Kaven Penmichow. Kaven has written several wonderful plays, including Public Heroics Commission, Blue, A Playlet, One Tough Cookie, and Subreddit. But he's also an accomplished actor, having appeared on CBS's Madam Secretary and on stage in Lincoln Center's production of The King and I in its national tour, as well as in the UK and Tokyo. I've asked Kaven to join us here today to talk about writing for radio, being an actor playwright, and the origins of his incredible story, The Return. Kaven, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You know, when I first asked you, hey, do you think you have any interest in writing one of our radio plays? You came up with a whole bunch of ideas. You had a whole slew of them. But this is the one that spoke to you the most. This is a story, a legend that stayed with you, and you thought that you could adapt and turn into something really special. Why this tale?
I think as a type person, Menag is a legend that we all know. It's a huge part of the culture. And it's been adapted in Thailand in many forms. Films and television shows and also radio pieces long ago. And I thought it had something really interesting to say about the nature of grief. I think it had something interesting to say about loss. And I really wanted to explore that, especially as an Asian playwright, wanting to explore a piece from my own culture and bring it to a Western audience was something that was really, really tempting and exciting for me.
I absolutely loved working on it in so many ways because the story, the structure, the characters' voices, the sense of place, the haunting quality to it, all of this was so evocative in the language that you brought to this story. And I wondered in particular, why did you choose to set it at the end of the Second World War? And what did that do in changing the story for you or making it even more personal?
I think I chose the Second World War because collectively, in our imagination, it's something that we're all really familiar with. But it's a different angle. I don't think a lot of people know that Thailand at the time was allied with the Axis powers and that the prime minister had done so out of preservation for the country. It's a conflict that is close to our minds that we all have some sort of relationship to. That felt like a way in for me and I hope for our audience. To kind of understand a different side of the conflict than we normally learn about here. And because it had such large ramifications for societal structures and family structures afterwards, that was something I really wanted to explore there. So, yeah.
The nostalgia of it also plays into the haunting quality of the story. It's a chilling tale, but it's also so nostalgic. And as we cast our minds back, and what is it about a ghost story that makes such a good play, especially when dealing with grief and loss and things like that? Why did a ghost story speak to you in so many ways?
Oh gosh, my partner Ovid says that a lot of my stories deal with death. It's not really death. It's more about transitions. I think ghost stories are like a transition in a way. I think you're always dealing with spirits who haven't fully let go of their mortal coil, so to speak, right? The ghost story is the ultimate dramatic problem. People have unfinished business that they need to attend to. My parents grew up around this time. They were both born around this time period. So I think that's also partially why I said it right after World War II, is because it kind of allowed me a chance to play historian and ask my parents like questions about their upbringing and what the texture of Thailand was like at the time. So
there's something about this story also. It's right there in the title when you chose to title it The Return. It's not only somebody coming back home, but after the war, but it's also the spirit of Nag and her child who are returning and lingering for this unfinished business. When you were investigating and asking your parents all those questions about their upbringing in Thailand at the time, were you in your mind returning to Thailand, thinking about the ways in which you wanted to dramatize it and give us those sights and sounds and the voices and the people, because it's so rich, the play is so rich with the world you've created for us?
Any chance I have to revisit Thailand in new contexts is something that I take. I'm very fascinated by legacies. I think being a first-generation American and the child of immigrants, I'm always fascinated and enthralled by stories about big journeys and the legacies we leave behind. Going and being able to talk to my parents about it was huge. I learned things I had never heard before, or my parents had never really felt compelled to talk about before, even just in the excavation of this play. And then it allowed me a chance to kind of set a scene for people of all the things I love about Thailand. I mentioned to John Gramada, our phenomenal sound designer and producer, that the sound and the air in Thailand has a texture. The air has weight, and the light has texture. And those are all things I've always wanted to convey to people in a piece. And I think this was my chance to do that.
I love the opening in particular on the boat, the sense of arriving someplace, the sound of the marketplace, and then that journey down the stretch to the house. As you were writing it, you'd send me some drafts and you would start to describe that the house that you were writing reminded you of the house that your grandfather lived in and built. Were you seeing all those images in your mind and making it very personal in the images that you created?
Yeah, to paint a scene, I suppose. My father's parents owned a home that sat on top of a marsh. And so in order to get to it, my family owned this huge complex of houses. And at the very back wall, behind the brick wall of the lot, was a door. You open the door, and there's just this wooden bridge that has, like, one side of it is, like, shoved into an embankment, and the other side of it is just open marsh, like water and bracken. And you have to walk across this bridge just to get to the front porch of my grandparents' home. All throughout my childhood, like, that was very formative for me, how vastly different it was to, like, my home in the States. I totally borrowed from that. I loved being able to, like, return to Thailand in a way.
Let me ask you, you are, if you don't mind my asking, you are an accomplished actor. You have trod the boards all over the country, and you know your way around the stage. And I was wondering, what's it like for an actor to write for other actors? How have you leaned into your own experience as an actor, as a playwright?
I think the beauty of being able to write for other actors is that I'm very familiar with how other actors process material and the things that actors want to play with and talk about. Language, how it's structured, how it's used, where it's used, and how character reveals itself. Like, that is hugely important for me as an actor. So it informs every part of my writing. I want to write things that actors like to say. It's also fun, though, I will say, because now I'm writing for more than one character. I think as an actor, you're very focused on one character, and that character's journey through a piece. But here you're tracking a lot more. There's a really interesting animation technique where a lot of animators, they have a mirror while they're animating, and they'll, like, make faces, or they'll, like, act out a scene so that they can animate it. And it's a bit of the same for me. I will literally sit at the computer and I'll be like, what is the most logical thing that someone would say in response to this?
I have this image of you sitting at your keyboard, acting out all the characters and doing the whole performance on your own. And we should record that too.
It definitely happened. I was like, ooh, yes, I know what I want to say here. And oh, this is the beat. I got the beat. Okay.
Let's talk about the sense of language, though. It's so beautiful and lyrical in so many ways. There are times where, you know, as an audience, we're listening to essentially a translation. And so you're playing with language. And there are times when you lean in into things that could not be said or translated into English that you use from the Thai language. And I'm wondering, how did you make those choices, and where did those places creep in for you, and what did it mean to you?
Thai language is really interestingly structured. It's quite a lyrical language, but also at the same time, its imagery is very evocative. And so I really wanted to bring that texture into the writing itself. And I found that with Nag, for example, because she's so otherworldly, I leaned into a much more formalized structure to how she speaks. Mm-hmm. It's much more lyrical when she speaks. And the closer she gets to being earthbound, the less that structure occurs. And when I would make choices about the Thai language and using Thai language in the piece, it came at points where I felt characters were being incredibly intimate with each other. I wanted to find moments where the regular language just didn't suffice. That's when the Thai comes in. And Thai has such beautiful terms of endearment that I had growing up, that I heard growing up. And so those to me were like little intimacy nuggets that people had between each other. Ja, na, ka, like that. Those are little sweet little words that people say to each other. And so it was moments where I wanted the intimacy to really come up to the forefront, like when Dang sings to his daughter.
In the lullaby, you have a lyric, "As insects buzz, a morning song." And I got such a kick out of the fact that John included an insect that buzzed occasionally whenever something ghostly was about to happen. But the sound that got me most in the piece was the sound of that baby warbling or crying, especially when Dang takes the child to the market and he's singing to the child or you know, speaking to it. And we hear the child crying, and we then realize in hindsight that no one else could hear the kid, that no one else could even see the kid. He was living in his own world, if you will. And so he sees things that others don't. There are two things going on in the play. One is Dang's reality, and the one is the other characters on the outside who are looking at him differently. And that creates such a dramatic tension. And there's a sorrow in it. I was wondering if you could explore further the characters who were the supporting characters in Dang's story, like Padi and also his cousin. Are these characters that you drew from particular people in your life, particularly your auntie?
Yeah, I definitely drew on people I knew for the other characters. Buddy specifically, I basically consolidated every aunt I have. My mom is the middle of five sisters, and my dad has four sisters. So my dad's the only guy in his family. He's the eldest, and then he has four sisters. No. He has five. He has five sisters. Oh my gosh. I forgot one of my aunts.
We won't tell her.
So I grew up with lots of really strong, loving, charismatic women. Yeah, I definitely wanted to include the fussy, loving, but slightly overbearing like auntie that I grew up with, because they're such a big part of the fabric of my life, and actually a huge part of the fabric of like Thai life when I was a kid growing up. So Padi in this one makes curry paste, right? And she sells curry paste. When I was a kid growing up, I have such strong memories of my aunts all convening together for like maybe like a big family gathering and just cooking massive amounts of food. Sitting like on little stools making curry paste all together with like these big mortar and pestles. And so that I was like, oh, I gotta include that somehow, because that's such a like a sense memory from my life. The smell, the sound, the chatter, the chattering all around me. And then for Putt's a hard character. He's got a lot going on inside of him, and I didn't base him necessarily on anybody I knew specifically, but I think I based maybe his sort of like the way he deals with the world on a cousin of mine who is quite circumspect, kind of keeps to himself. He keeps things very close to his chest. And that was a big inspiration for Putt. And I just then imagined, I was like, what would life be like if Putt had to go through a war? And that's kind of where that character came from.
Caven, every time you sent me a draft, whenever you spoke about Deng, you had great sympathy for what he was going through. Now, it's entirely possible that his wife and child aren't waiting for him when he returns home, that he's conjured this all up to deal with his grief. And yet again, it's also entirely possible that indeed these spirits are around him and he is being haunted. Do you feel like answering whether or not this haunting is real or not?
It's a little bit of both, I think. In many iterations of this legend, people make the choice that it's one or the other. And in Thailand, more often than not, it tends to be a ghost story. Like Nag is an actual ghost. But I was really struck by the thought that for anybody who comes from a traumatic situation, that the mind often searches for things to comfort them and ways to comfort them and soothe them. I know that for myself, just from personal experience, you know. So it's very possible that Deng has conjured them in his mind to kind of return to a sense of normalcy that he had before he left for the war. But it's also very possible that Nag herself has unfinished business and she's come back to haunt him because she's not done with living life. And I actually kind of wanted to play with the idea that it's a little bit of both. So then the notion came out that he brings her back to life, essentially. But I think the audience can make their own decisions about, is she a ghost or is she a conjuring of his own creation?
Even at the end of the piece, when he still sort of grapples with feeling alone, I've listened to it a number of times, and there are times where I hear it and I go, oh, he's conjured this up in his mind. Other times where I say, oh no, she's real. That ghost is real. But either way, he does have this beautiful act of giving over this sense of release to that spirit. And so at the end of the play, I always take from it, and people can take from it what they will, that even if he's in a new place and it's still hard, that there's life left to be lived and that he must figure out what it means to move forward. And I think there's something really just extraordinary about how you finish this piece and let the ambiguity sit there. Every time you sent me a new version, a new idea, a new draft, I saw you digging in deeper and further. And I was so honored and pleased to direct this piece with our extraordinary cast and with John doing original music and sound and audio design. It was really an extraordinary experience to watch you create this world for us, and such a privilege. I want to congratulate you and thank you.
Thank you.
This is Mark Lamus, Artistic Director of the Westport Country Playhouse, thanking you for joining us.